Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Enrique Huerta. He's the Legislative Director at Climate Resolve. This is another in our series of podcasts about the works of Climate Resolve, one of Los Angeles' most important nonprofit organizations focusing on climate change, adaptation, and resilience. Delighted to have Enrique on the podcast today. Enrique, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm great, Ted. Thanks for having me on your amazing and mazeful podcast. You've covered a lot of ground and are widening the conversation and nuance around environmentalism and climate change. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks for saying so. It's been a pleasure to be interviewing people like yourself that are really doing a lot of inspiring things. Now, I already introduced you as the Legislative Director at Climate Resolve in Los Angeles. Are you in Los Angeles right now, or so many people are working remotely? How about you?
Yeah, I'm sitting in my office here in downtown Los Angeles Arts District. We are at the Los Angeles Clean Tech Incubator, a really neat building that houses a lot of organizations and really smart people that are all trying to find their own solutions to this climate change problem. And if you've never been to the Downtown Arts District, it's kind of a neat area in transition as well. It used to be a major manufacturing and warehousing hub, and then for a while it transitioned into an artist loft district, where artists would just come in and live in these abandoned, you know, warehouses. And since then, it's transitioned into a high-rise and fancy restaurant and fancy office district. But yeah, there's still some seediness. last Friday when I walked out to my car and noticed that somebody had stole my tailgate. And as I stood there just looking blankly at the empty bed of my truck, I couldn't help but hear a quote from the movie There Will Be Blood, where Daniel Day-Lewis's character is in a restaurant and some oil executives walk in. And these were oil executives that at one point lowballed him on one of his wells. And he walks up and shoves it in their face that he had just done a deal with a rival oil company. And I remember him distinctly saying, "Don't you feel like a fool, Tifford?" And that's what rang in my mind as I stood there looking at my empty bed. I turned around and came back into my office and restarted doing the people's work.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm sorry about the tailgate. And Lacey is a fantastic facility and lots of inspiration there. So I'm jealous of you, or I think you're lucky to be there. What is in your work? What's happening this week? I know you're the legislative director, but what's your focus this week?
Well, Ted, we ran a bill this year, AB 2684, and that made it through the legislative process, and it's currently on the governor's desk, waiting to be signed. So I am optimistically hopeful that he will sign that bill before the end of the month, which is the deadline for him to do so. And the legislative team and I have been working diligently to advocate for him to do so. And that bill is one in a long series of extreme heat adaptation bills that we have run over the years. What that bill looks to do is open up an entirely new pot of funding for local communities to tap into money to adapt their communities to extreme heat. So it's called the Safety Element Extreme Heat Bill. I like to call it Cities Stop Leaving Money on the Table Bill, because it mandates that by 2028, when cities update their safety element to their general plan, they have to explicitly address their vulnerability to extreme heat. And by doing so, they align this very important local planning document with the state hazard mitigation plan. And that would increase their award eligibility to win pre-hazard mitigation funds from FEMA. And because the state is in such a dire budget deficit, we feel like this could really offset some of the budget cuts that have been made to important programs throughout the state.
Very interesting. So this week, or this past, the past couple weeks in Southern California have been just insanely hot. It has been just the extreme heat that you're talking about. So it must have fueled your passion for the climate justice issues that, that Climate Resolve is working on.
It really brought the issue home. I come from a community in Southeast Los Angeles where, you know, if you look at some of the demographics, you quickly find out that this is a very vulnerable region to the county. We have something like 93% of the population that identifies as non-white. We have two-thirds of the residents falling into the low-income category. We have health issues, like 33% of the population is obese. And we just have a lot of industry in the area. In fact, the Southeast LA region is known as the gateway to the global imports that come from the City of LA and City of Long Beach ports. So it's characterized by planes, trains, automobiles, and planes. So those are some of the issues that we know that extreme heat really, really exacerbates. You know, communities that don't have enough shade, where they're overly exposed to UV rays, communities that suffer from legacy medical issues as a result sometimes from this overexposure. And then we also have communities that when they're hit with an expensive emergency room bill, they're the least able to bounce back from that economic impact. So, you know, Southeast LA is the poster child of extreme heat vulnerability for the region.
Right. And if we had ample funds, then you could wave your wand. You mentioned shading. I know that urban forestry, urban tree cover is an important part of your work. Just list, what are some of the other ways that, that we can actually help a community cool?
Yeah, so, you know, urban tree canopy has been a very popular and historic method for communities to cool themselves. But because extreme heat, because the mercury is rising, we need to also widen the toolbox that's available to communities. And some of the tools that we are currently exploring and piloting has to do with cool pavements. These are pavements that are coated with a special kind of paint that comes in a variety of colors that blocks the sun from being absorbed by the various surfaces. And basically it reflects a certain kind of radiation that creates heat back into space. But we also have other tools that we have been working on, particularly community resilience centers, which are places that promote community cohesion, not just during times of disaster, but also during what we call blue sky days. Study after study indicates that people are able to withstand extreme heat disasters when they know their neighbors and they can rely on each other to take care of each other. So those are two other strategies that we are promoting. We're also promoting a lot more collaboration between not just community members on the ground, but with sectors that haven't traditionally been part of this extreme heat conversation. So I have organized several statewide organizations into what we call the ICE Heat Collaborative, the Integrated Climate Committee on Extreme Heat. And we have invited public health professionals. We have invited labor and worker protection organizations. And we've also invited industry that's involved with extreme heat adaptation innovations.
Oh, interesting. And really, is the key, I mean, obviously, the part of the key is raising awareness about what to do about the extreme heat. And then a big part of the issue is how to fund these measures. You mentioned FEMA before. I take it there's FEMA, there's federal monies, there's some state monies you said are limited. Are there other sources of funding that I'm not thinking about? Or are corporations getting involved in private sector grants and donations and things like that as well?
Yeah, we've been really, really targeting a lot of our efforts, engaging philanthropy and redirecting their gaze towards a people-centered approach to climate change. There are several studies out there that will show bar graphs of where philanthropy has traditionally put their money. And when it comes to climate resilience, it's less than 1%. By far, nationally. We've been really lucky. We have a tremendous development team here at Climate Resolve who has made significant inroads with several philanthropic donors and funders. But we also advocated in 2022 for the state to establish a landmark grant program called the Extreme Heat and Community Resilience Program. And what that grant program looks to do is, rather than funding one solution at a time, it's now looking to fund an integrated and comprehensive approach to combating extreme heat in neighborhoods, which I think could really go a long way to create really interesting partnerships moving forward. Partners that have traditionally worked in silos. This program could really bring them together in the future.
And did that program get funded? Was it approved?
So that program was established during the historic budget surplus years. And initially, it received $175 million to get off the ground. In 2023, that program received a budget cut of about $45 million. In 2024, that program was reduced to $75 million. So we still have a significant amount of money that could really go a long way to prepare our communities through a variety of cooling strategies into the future.
Then would those be, if a community was interested in that, would that be a planning grant that they would be going after, or would that fund some of the implementation as well?
Yeah, it does both. So my understanding is round one funding will be dispersed in October, and that's going to cover the planning grants, and then funding for implementation grants will be dispersed in December. So the Governor's Office of Land Use and Climate Innovations is administering this program, and they have gotten the ball rolling. And I'm really excited to see what kinds of projects and planning takes place over the next, few months.
Yeah, that's really great. I was afraid that we were going to have a sort of a downturn in the conversation when you were going to say to me, Ted, you know, we know what the solutions are. We have lots of tools in this toolbox, but the real issue is money. And but you're saying, no, here there is innovation coming out of the state of California. It sounds like this other bill that you started off talking about would stretch the definition of and allow for some FEMA money to also come in from the federal government. So we actually have, there are some funding sources, not as much as we need probably, but there are some funding sources for this.
There are funding sources. There's also an extreme heat action plan that spells out and lays out a blueprint for local communities to pick up on when preparing their communities to extreme heat. And we're proud to say that that was a result of advocacy that we did with several partners back in 2021. And it does a really good job of outlining various tracks and actions that communities can take to not just protect themselves, but to protect critical infrastructure and property as well. And so this grant program that I just mentioned is established to implement that extreme heat action plan. Now, all that to say, one major key that's missing from that extreme heat action plan is coordination. Right now, it's more of a catalog of strategies that communities can take, but study after study, planning recommendation after planning recommendation points towards the need for a central office and someone at the helm coordinating mm-hmm. how all these strategies will be implemented. And that's missing at the state level.
I think I've seen on the news that some cities, I'm thinking Baltimore for some reason, have extreme heat officers. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, there's a few cities nationally that have adopted chief heat officers. We're proud to say that here in the city of LA, we have Ms. Marta Segura, who's our chief heat officer, and she's doing an amazing job when it comes to getting the word out to the most impacted communities about how to protect themselves during heat waves. She has enlisted trusted messengers and trusted partners. She's come up with a really, really strong heat awareness campaign. So we're really proud of that work. There's a lot more that can be done. And she's also working on adopting or putting together an extreme heat resilience plan as we speak. So she's moving the needle in the right direction. And we are continuing to work with her office on a lot of those initiatives.
Very good. And a question related is, I understand that we now have an extreme heat standard for workers. Is that right?
Yeah, we're also really proud of this initiative. Climate Resolve partnered with workforce protection organizations a few years back to really remind the Cal OSHA Standards Board that they needed to meet the mandate of SB 1167. This was a bill that was passed in 2016, and it mandated that the Cal OSHA Standards Board adopt a standard by January 2019. When we re-engaged the process, it was 2022, and no standard had been put in place. So really, we were part of like this historic collaboration between climate activists and traditional labor and workforce protection organizations coming together in a very organized and strategic manner to advocate for this indoor heat illness prevention standard, which was adopted finally on July 23rd of this year. So we're really happy about that. It's not a perfect standard, but it's enough to save lives moving forward.
Very interesting. Well, very good stuff. Now, is that a statewide standard? It
yes,
is.
Yes, that's a statewide
standard. And then did you use the word indoor in there when you were describing it?
Yeah, that was specifically for indoor workers. It covers every indoor worker setting you can think of, with some exceptions. Like, I believe it doesn't cover emergency personnel, for example. It doesn't cover spaces where workers spend less than 15 minutes doing work in. And there's a few other exceptions as well. But yeah, that's a specific standard for indoor workers. There is an outdoor worker standard that's been around since 2007. So this is a landmark standard that was adopted. Now, that's not to say that there's still a lot more work to be done. For example, the issue of enforcement is still up in the air. Currently, there are 140 vacancies at Cal OSHA, and they're having a real difficult time filling those vacancies in. And as a result, you know, workers are still at risk of serious injury.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad you clarified the indoor versus the outdoor. I was thinking the whole time it was outdoor, not indoor. And I was thinking about, I used to have an office out in Palm Desert and thought about the folks that are putting up solar systems in the middle of the summer up on those rooftops where I think the temperatures are up 130, 140 degrees. And I presume that with that 2007 standard, there are the requirements for hydration every periodically and coming off the roof and things like that. Is that how it works for the indoor, or is it more of a temperature thing? Is that the owner of the building must maintain a certain or meet a certain threshold temperature?
Yeah, it's both. So with regards to indoor, when the temperature reaches 82 degrees, then mandatory breaks are required. Access to cool water is required, and so forth and so on. When the temperature reaches 87 degrees, then the employer must already have in place a method to keep that temperature stable. Those methods mm-hmm. could be via mechanical cooling or in very kind of advanced and forward-thinking ways. The owner could get upgrades to the building to allow for more passive ventilation and things of that nature. Even cool roofs, for example, would could possibly be eligible to maintain that standard. So it's a very forward-thinking standard that doesn't just take into consideration temperatures today, but the rising mercury into the future as well.
That's what I was going to say. Lead, I was going to follow on with that. It just seems like the situation is, you would expect that it's going to get worse and worse, and therefore the standard will become more and more, the standards, plural, will become more and more important.
That's right. That's right. And you know, we have internally here at Climate Resolve, we're working not just to adapt our communities to extreme heat, but we also know that it's important for the state to set standards that we could then measure up our success to. We're also looking to advance readiness and preparedness, effective response during extreme heat, like I mentioned, lessen exposure, grow adaptive capacity, build community resilience. These are all things that we are trying to accomplish throughout the state. And this is a very recent conversation in the climate change space, as in the past, climate change was defined by the need to conserve and preserve our natural lands. And we feel like living in California, living in a biodiversity hotspot, which is one of 36 across the globe, that's super important. But we also need to center people's health in this conversation. And that's the needle that we're trying to move legislatively and at the planning level as well.
I salute your works. And like you were saying, the cohesion, you mentioned the cooling centers, that you know might think, some of us might think, oh, it's a cooling place for people to go to get cool. But no, this is where you're building cohesion in a community. This is where you're building a certain set of societal, I guess it's a societal resilience. It's terrific that you've got that whole side of this equation. It's just not a technological. There aren't just technological fixes here. There's societal fixes that are equally important. Enrique, I wanted to ask you, with your job as legislative director, which sounds broad, perhaps too broad, how do you prioritize? Because obviously you've got city of LA stuff that you're right in within the city, you've got regional stuff, you've got county, state, national, even international legislation that is pertinent to your job and pertinent to Los Angelinos. How do you prioritize there?
Yeah, well, it comes down to having a strong legislative team who can help you with a lot of the planning, which I have. But also, it comes down to relationships. You know, it's not uncommon for me to get information from several people at the city or the county, giving me a heads up about things that are on their horizon or important resolutions that decision makers are considering. And this relationship building extends way beyond when I first started here at Climate Resolve. So a lot of that groundwork was laid by my coworkers and people that were here, you know, my predecessors as well. Jonathan Parfrey is an excellent relationship builder. He's been a integral part in priority setting, and I rely a lot on his counsel and guidance. But ultimately, it's just being in the mix, getting to know people, understanding what they're working on, reaching out to partners in the environmental justice community to understand some of their priorities as well, and then trying to come up with some kind of integrated or cross-sectoral priority that I can then bring all of these people with me to Sacramento when I'm knocking on doors or speaking to decision makers.
I was thinking of the word coalitions. You're a master at building coalitions to move legislation, which is an art. And like you said, it's got a lot to do with networking, doesn't it?
It really does. I don't know that I'm at the level of building a coalition. A coalition to me means that it's a very kind of active and vested group of people that are all moving in the same direction. I like to use the word collaborative because most of my partners have their own goals, and my job is to just give them as much information on extreme heat adaptation. Again, this is a very new conversation, and try and relate it to some of the work that they're already doing. And that's kind of been an effective strategy for me to at least keep them engaged. But that work continues to maybe one day make it into a very strong coalition. Mm-hmm. But baby steps at this point, Ted.
Let me ask you just a few personal questions. How did you end up in this position? You were born and raised in Los Angeles, right?
That's right. Born in East LA, raised in Southgate.
And as a child, you must have seen the pollution of Los Angeles. You probably saw the best and the worst of Los Angeles, and at an early age became passionate about making a difference. Is that fair to say?
That is extremely fair and on point. Absolutely.
So how did you get inspired? What was that inspiration? What triggered your action?
That's a really good question. You know, growing up in Southgate, every single day when I walked out the door, I saw lots of cars. I saw lots of 18-wheelers. We were underneath the LAX flight path, so lots of planes, lots of helicopters. Anywhere in Southgate that you look, you're going to find a 300-foot electrical lattice that's just carrying electrons all over the place. So I think that early on, I really got acquainted with the community. I walked everywhere because my mother never drove. So that really gave me a more intimate perspective on communities. Mm. And so when I went to college, I majored in urban and regional planning. I got an internship with the city of Southgate and worked there for a long time as a city planner. But I also realized that the same pollution issues that were around prior to joining that office were still around 10 years later. And I felt like there was something missing. So I went back to school, enrolled at the Lyell Center for Regenerative Studies, got a master's of science degree in regenerative studies, and then emerged and did a little consulting. And then I became a community organizer, following the rich Chicano tradition of community organizers, because as you know, most, if not all, of the gains that we've made haven't come magically from government. We've had to advocate and fight for them. And so that's what I did. I became an organizer, an educator, and an agitator to create a green space out of vacant lots all over LA, including Watts, South LA, and Southeast LA. And I did that for several years.
Talk about that. I saw that you were with an organization called From Lot to Spot, but I presume that that was doing just what you mentioned, the creating green spaces.
That's right. We were identifying vacant lots and working with the property owners to create much needed green space throughout LA County. And doing that community organizing work really opened my eyes to the resilience that lots of impoverished communities have. And it also made me realize that a lot of this advocacy on the work is women-led. And we're talking about women sometimes who were elderly. We're talking women who were responsible for their home and for caregiving, caregiving to their children and to their elderly folks, and even some of their elderly neighbors. And so you talk about community cohesion, that's already in place in a lot of these communities. And we could really learn a lot from going into these communities and becoming part of that fabric. And I think that many times in state and local planning, this gender inequality is oftentimes missed. So that was something that I was really proud to be a part of. And it was, like I said, a lot of the times women-led advocacy. My role was just to fill in some of the areas that my expertise could help with, particularly talking to local government, identifying resources for the community, and facilitating conversations as well.
Oh, great. Oh, great. Well, you seem like just the right guy to be in this role, given your passion, your background, your vision. So thank you so much for what you're doing, and thank you so much for being on our podcast. And let's tune in again in a couple of years and hear about all your next steps, if that's okay.
That would be wonderful, Ted. Looking forward to it. And thank you for reaching out. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.